No, someone disappeared the tape.
Oh?
I stopped at a light and stared at Butters for a second. When you saw that tape, did you believe it?
No.
Why not? He took a breath.
Well, because the picture quality wasn't very good. I mean, it was really dark.
Where most scary supernatural stuff tends to happen, I said.
And the picture was all jumpy.
The woman with the camera was terrified, also pretty common. Butters made a frustrated sound.
And there was an awful lot of static on the tape, which made it look like someone had messed with it.
Sort of like someone messed with almost all my X-rays? I shook my head, smiling. And there's one more reason you didn't believe it, man. It's okay. You can say it. He sighed.
There's no such thing as monsters.
Bingo, I said, and got the car moving again. Look, Butters, you are your own ideal example. You've seen things you can't explain away. You've suffered for trying to tell people that you have seen them. For God's sake, 20 minutes ago you got attacked by the Walking Dead, and you're still arguing with me about whether or not magic is real. Seconds ticked by.
Because I don't want to believe it,
he said in a quiet, numb voice. I exhaled slowly. Yeah. Dead silence. Drink some coffee, I told him. He did. Scared?
Yeah.
Good, I said. That's smart.
Well, then,
he murmured,
I must be the smartest guy in the whole world.
I know how you feel, I said. You run into something you totally don't get, and it's scary as hell. But once you learn something about it, it gets easier to handle. Knowledge counters fear. It always has.
What do I do? Butters asked me.
I'm taking you somewhere you'll be safe. Once I get you there, I'll figure out my next move. For now, ask me questions. I'll answer them. Butters took a slower sip of his coffee and nodded. His hands looked steadier.
Who was that man?
He goes by Gravain, but I doubt that's his real name. He's a necromancer.
What's a necromancer?
I rolled a shoulder in a shrug. Necromancy is the practice of using magic to muck around with dead things. Necromancers can animate and control corpses, manipulate ghosts, access the knowledge stored in dead brains. Butters blurted out,
That's impossible.
Then he stopped himself and coughed.
Oh, right. Sorry.
They can also do a lot of really freaky things involving the soul, I said. Even in the weird circles, it isn't the kind of thing you talk about casually. But I've heard stories that they can inhabit corpses with a consciousness, possess others. I've even heard that they can bring people back from the dead.
Jesus,
Butters swore.
Kinda doubt he had anything to do with that one.
No, I meant...
I know what you meant. It was a joke, Butters.
Oh, right. Sorry.
He swigged more coffee and started looking around at the streets again.
But bringing the dead to life? That doesn't sound so bad.
You're assuming that what the necromancer brings them back to is better than death. From what I've heard, they don't generally do it for humanitarian reasons. But that might be a load of crap. Like I said, no one talks about it.
Why not?
Butters asked. Because it's forbidden, I told him. The practice of necromancy violates one of the laws of magic laid down by the White Council. Capital punishment is the only sentence, and no one wants to even come close to being suspected by the Council.
Why? Who are they?
They're me, I said. Sort of. The White Council is a... Well, most people would call it a governing body for wizards all over the world, but it's really more like a Masonic lodge, or maybe a frat.
I've never heard of a fraternity handing out a death sentence.
Yeah, well, the council only has 7 laws, but if you break them... I drew my thumb across my neck. By the way, they aren't fond of regular folks knowing about them, so don't talk about them to anyone else. Butters swallowed and touched the fingers of one hand to his throat.
Oh, so this guy, Gravain... He was like you?
He's not like me, I said, and it came out in a snarl that surprised even me. Butters twitched violently. I sighed and made an effort to lower my voice again. But he's probably a wizard, yeah.
Who is he? What does he want?
I blew out a breath. He's most likely a student of this badass black magic messiah named Kemler. The council burned Kemler down a while back, but several of his disciples may have escaped. I think Gravain is looking for a book his teacher hid before he died.
A magic book?
I snorted. Nah, trinkets aren't too hard to come by. If my guess is correct, this book contains more of the knowledge and theory Kemler used in his most powerful magics. Butters nodded.
So, if Gravain gets hold of the book and learns, he gets to be the next Kemler?
Yeah, and he mentioned that there were others involved in this business, too. I think word of the presence of Kemler's book came up, and his surviving students are showing up to grab it before their fellow necromancers do. For that matter, just about anyone involved in black magic might want to get their hands on it.
So why doesn't the council just grab them and...
He drew his thumb across his throat. They've tried, I said. They thought the disciples had all been accounted for. Butters frowned. Then he said,
I guess wizards can go into denial about uncomfortable things too, huh?
I barked out a laugh. People are people, man.
But now you can tell this council about Gravain and this book, right?
My stomach quivered a little. No.
Why not?
Because if I did, Mavra would destroy my friend. The thought screamed across my brain in a blaze of frustration that I tried to keep concealed. Long story. The short version is that I'm not real popular with the council, and they're pretty busy right now.
With what? He asked.
A war. He scrunched up his nose and tilted his head, studying me.
That's not the only reason you aren't calling them, is it?
Butters said. Egad, Holmes, I told him. No, it isn't.
Don't push. Sorry.
He finished the coffee, then made a visible effort to cast around for a new conversational thread.
So, those were actual zombies?
Never seen one before, I said, but that seems like a pretty good guess.
Poor Phil, Butters said. Not a saint or anything, but not a bad guy.
You have a family? I asked.
No, Butters said. Single. That's a mercy.
He was silent for a second, then said,
No, I guess it isn't.
Yeah.
If those guys were zombies, how come they didn't want brains?
Butters said. He held both arms stiff out in front of him, rolled his eyes back in his head, and moaned,
Brains.
I snorted. He gave me a weak smile.
Seriously, Butters said. These guys were more like the Terminator.
What's the use of a foot soldier who can't do anything but hobble along and moan about brains?
Good point, Butters said.
He scrunched up his nose and thought.
Don't I remember something about sewing a zombie's lips shut with thread to kill them? Does that work?
No clue, I said. But you saw those things. If you want to get close enough to find out, be my guest. But I'll be observing it through a freaking telescope.
No, thank you, Butters said. But how do we stop them?
I sighed. They're tough, but they're still flesh and bone. Massive trauma will do it sooner or later.
How massive?
I shrugged. Run them over with a truck, chop them to bits with an axe, burn them to ashes. A gun or a baseball bat won't do it.
This may come as a shock to you, Harry, but I don't have an axe with me. Is there something else? Maybe something that isn't so Bunyan-esque?
Plenty, I said. If you can cut off the flow of energy into them, they'll drop.
How do you do that?
You'd have to ground them out. Running water is the best way, but there needs to be a lot of it. A small stream, at least. I could also probably trap one in a magic circle and cut off any energy from getting to it. Either way, they just fall over. Plop.
Magic circles, Butters shook his head. And nothing else?
Keep in mind that they aren't intelligent, I said. Zombies follow orders, but they don't have much more intellect than your average animal. You have to outthink them, or the necromancer who is giving them orders. You could also cut off the necromancer's control of them.
How?
Kill their drum.
What?
I shook my head. Sorry. A zombie, well, It isn't really a person with thoughts and feelings as such, but a corpse is used to being a person, to eating, breathing, and to a beating heart. That's how the necromancer controls them. He plays a beat or some kind of rhythmic music and uses magic to substitute his beat for the zombie's heartbeat. He links himself to the beat to the zombie's heart, and when the necromancer gives a command, as far as the zombie is concerned, it's coming from inside him, and he wants to do it. That's how they can control them so completely.
That book, Butters said. Gravain kept drumming it against his leg. And then outside, that huge bass woofer in that Cadillac.
Exactly. Make the beat stop or get the zombies out of earshot, and he loses control of them. But that's really dicey.
Why?
Because it won't destroy the zombie. It just frees it from the necromancer's control. Anything could happen. It could just shut down, or it could start killing everyone it sees. Totally unpredictable. If I'd stopped him from drumming in the exam room, they might have killed us all. Or run off in different directions to hurt other people. We couldn't afford to take the chance. Butters nodded, absorbing this for a minute. Then he piped up with,
Gravain said you weren't a warden. What is a warden?
Wardens are the White Council's version of cops, I said. They enforce the laws of magic, bring criminals in for a trial, and then they chop off their heads. Sometimes they get enthusiastic and just skip to the chopping.
Well, that doesn't sound so bad.
In theory, I said, but they're so paranoid that next to them, Joe McCarthy looks like a friendly puppy. They don't ask many questions, and they don't hesitate to make up their minds. If they think you've broken a law, you might as well have.
That's not fair, Butters said.
No, it isn't. I'm not real popular with the wardens. I'm not sure they'd come out to help me if I asked them.
What about other wizards on the council?
I sighed. The White Council is already at the limits of its resources. Even if they weren't, the council really, really likes to not get involved. He frowned.
Could the cops stop Gravain?
No way, I said. Not a chance in hell are any of them prepared to handle him. And if they tried, a whole lot of good people would die. Butters sputtered.
They'll just sit there and let people like Phil get killed?
He demanded, his voice outraged.
If regular people can't do it, and the council won't get involved, who the hell is going to stop him?
I am, I said. Chapter 7. We went back to my apartment, and I wasted no time getting Butters inside and behind the protection of my wards. Mouse loomed up from my little kitchen alcove and padded over to me, tail wagging.
Holy crap, Butters said. You have a pony.
I said. Mouse sniffed at my hand and then walked over to snuffle around Butters' legs with a certain solemn ceremony. Then he sneezed and looked up at Butters, wagging his tail.
Can I pet him? Butters said.
If you do, he won't leave you alone. I went into my room to pick up a few things from my closet, and when I came back out, Butters was sitting on the hearth, poking the fire to life and feeding it fresh wood. Mouse sat nearby, watching with patient interest.
What breed is he? Butters asked.
Half chow and half woolly mammoth, a woolly chamoth. Mouse's jaws opened in a doggy grin.
Wow, some serious teeth there, Butters said. He doesn't bite, does he?
Only bad guys, I told him. I grabbed Mouse's lead and clipped it to his collar. I'm going to take him outside for a bit. I'll bring him back in. Then I want you to lock up and stay put. He hesitated in mid-poke.
You're leaving?
It's safe, I said. I've got measures in place here that will prevent Gravain from finding you by magical means.
You mean with a spell or something?
Yeah, I said. My spells should counter Gravain's and keep him from locating you while I get some things done.
You won't be here? Butters said.
He didn't sound too steady.
Gravain won't find you, I said. But what if he does anyway?
He won't.
Sure, sure, he won't. I believe you.
Butters swallowed.
But what if he does?
I tried to give him a reassuring smile. There are more wards in place to stop someone from coming in. Mouse will keep an eye on you, and I'll leave a note for Thomas and ask him to stay home tonight, just in case.
Who's Thomas?
Roommate, I said. I dragged a piece of paper and a pen out of a cabinet in the base of the coffee table and started writing the note. Thomas. Bad guys from my end of the block are trying to kill the little guy in the living room. His name is Butters. I brought him here to get him off the radar while I negotiate with them. Do me a favor and keep an eye on him until I get back. Harry. I folded the note and stuck it up on the mantel. He's smart and fairly tough. I'm not sure when he'll get back. When he does, tell him I brought you here and give him the note. You should be okay. Butters exhaled slowly.
All right. Where are you going?
To the bookstore, I said.
Why there?
Gravaine was reading a copy of a book called Die Lied der Erlking. I want to know why. Butters stared at me for a second and then said,
In all of that, with threats and guns and zombies and everything, you noticed the title of the book he was holding?
Yeah. Damn, I'm good.
What do I do?
He asked. Get some sleep. I waved a hand at my bookshelves. Read. Help yourself to anything in the kitchen. Oh, one more thing. Do not open the door for any reason.
Why not?
Because the spells on it might kill you.
Oh, he said. Of course, the spells.
No joking, Butters. They're meant to keep things out, but if you open the door, you could get caught in the backwash. Thomas has a talisman that will let him in safely. So do I. Anyone else will be in a world of hurt. So stand clear. He swallowed.
Right. Okay. What if the dog has to go?
I sighed. He can't mess the place up any worse than Thomas. Come on, Mouse. Let's make sure you'll be settled. Mouse seemed to have a sixth sense about when not to take his time, making use of the boarding house's yard. And we went to our little designated area and back with no delays. I got him back inside with Butters, revved up the Beetle, and headed for Bock-ordered books. Artemis Bock, proprietor of Chicago's oldest occult shop, had been a fixture near Lincoln Park for years before I had ever moved to town. The neighborhood was a bizarre blend of the worst a large city had to offer, marching side by side with the erudite academia of the University of Chicago. It wasn't the kind of place I wanted to walk around after dark, wizard or no, but there wasn't much choice. I parked the Beetle a block down from the shop, across the street from cheap apartments that were flying gang colors on the windows nearest the doors. I wasn't too worried that someone was going to steal the Blue Beetle while I was in the shop. The car just wasn't sexy enough to warrant stealing. But to be on the safe side, I made no pretense whatsoever of hiding my gun as I left the car and slipped it into a shoulder holster under my duster. I had my staff with me, too, and I took it firmly into my right hand as I shut the car door and started down the street with a purpose, my expression set and cold. I didn't have a concealed carry permit for the gun, so I could wind up in jail for toting it along with me. On the other hand, this part of town was a favorite spot for some of the nastier denizens of the supernatural community. Between them and the very real prospect of your everyday urban criminal, I could wind up in my grave for not toting it. I'd err on the side of survival, thank you very much. On the short walk to the store, I stepped over a pair of winos and tried to ignore a pale and too thin woman with empty eyes who staggered by in leopard print tights, a leather coat, and a bra. Her pupils had dilated until her blue eyes looked black, and she was nearly too stoned to walk. She probably wasn't old, but life had used her hard. She saw me, and for a second looked like she was going to display her wares, but she got a closer look at my face and skittered to one side and tried to become invisible. I went by her without comment. The night was very cold. In a few more weeks, it would get cold enough that people like the two drunks and the stoned girl would start freezing to death. Someone would see a body, and eventually someone would call the police. The cops would show up and fill out on the police report that the body had been found and presumed accidentally frozen to death. Sometimes it wasn't an accident. The weather was a convenient way for a dealer or for the outfit to kill someone who had gotten on their nerves. Something to knock them out, a removal of a bit of clothing, and leave them for the night to devour. Most of those bodies were found within a few blocks of where I was walking. Maybe 30 yards short of the shop, I crossed some kind of invisible line where the oppressive, dangerous atmosphere of the bad part of town lessened by several degrees. A few steps later, I caught my first glance of a U of C campus building far down the block. I felt myself relax a little in response, but that unspoken promise of safety and the rule of law was only an illusion. The closer you got to campus, the less crime occurred, but there was nothing other than convention and slightly more frequent police patrols to keep the darker elements of the city from pushing the boundaries. Well, there was one more thing, but I couldn't afford to get involved with it. Mavra's prohibition against involving anyone else meant that even if I wanted extra help, I didn't dare ask for it. I was on my own, and if trouble came looking, I'd have to handle it alone. Predators respond to body language. I walked like I was on my way to rip someone's face off until I made it to the shop and entered the store. Artemis Bach, proprietor, sat behind a counter facing the door. He was a bear of a man in his late 50s, broad-shouldered, unshaven, and heavy-set with weathered muscle under a layer of comfortable living. He had knuckles the size and texture of golf balls, marked with old scars from whatever career he'd pursued before he'd become a storekeeper. He wasn't anything so strong as a wizard, but he knew his way around Chicago, around basic magical theory, and his shop was protected with half a dozen subtle wards that did a lot to encourage people looking for trouble to look elsewhere. The door chimes tinkled as I came in, and there was a deeper chime from somewhere behind the counter. Bach had one arm on the counter and one out of sight under it until he peered over his reading glasses at my face and nodded. He folded his arms onto the counter again, hunched over what looked like an auto magazine, and said, "Mr. Dresden?" "Bach," I replied with a nod. His eyes flickered over my staff, and I got the impression that he noticed or sensed the gun under the jacket. "I need to get into the cage," I told him. His shaggy eyebrows drew together. "The wardens were here not a month ago. I run a clean shop, you know that." I lifted my gloved hand in a pacifying gesture. "This isn't an inspection tour. Personal business." He made a rumbling sound in his throat, something halfway between the sound of acknowledgement and one of apology. He reached behind him without looking and snagged a key from where it hung on a peg on the wall behind him. He flicked it at me. I had to let my staff fall into the crook of my left arm so that I could use my right hand to catch the key. I doubt it looked graceful, but at least I didn't drop the staff and the key both, which would have been more my speed. "You want to come along?" I asked him. Bach didn't let customers peruse the books in the cage without supervision. "What am I going to tell you?" he said, and turned the page in his magazine. I nodded and started for the back of the store. "Mr. Dresden," Bach said.
"Hmm?"
"Word is on the street that there's dark business afoot. Will was through here today. Said things were getting nervous." I paused. Billy Borden was the leader of a gang of genuine werewolves who called themselves the Alphas and lived in the neighborhood around campus. About 4 years before, the Alphas had learned how to shapeshift into wolves and had declared the campus area a monster-free zone. They backed it up by ripping monsters to shreds, and they did it well enough that the local underworld of vampires, ghouls, and various other nasties found it easier to hunt elsewhere. The magical community of Chicago, of people, I mean, was centered around a number of different neighborhoods in town. The clump around campus was the smallest, but probably the most informed of them. Word has a way of getting around the occult crowd when something vicious is on the warpath and sends them hurrying to seek shelter or keep their heads down. It was a survival instinct on behalf of those who were blessed with one form or another of talent for magic, but who didn't have enough power to be a credible threat, and one that I heartily encouraged. Things were bad enough without some amateur one-trick Willie deciding he was going to hat up and take on the bad guys. Of course, that was precisely what Billy Borden had done. Billy and company were not up to taking on people on Gravain's level. Don't get me wrong, they were a real threat to your average dark whatever, especially working together, but they weren't used to dealing with someone in Gravain's weight class. Billy needed to keep his head down, but I couldn't contact him to tell him that. Hell, even if I did, he'd just stick his jaw out at me and tell me he could handle it. So I had to play another angle to get him to lie low. "If you see him again," I told Bach, "let him know that I'd appreciate it if he'd keep his head down, his eyes open, and get in touch with me before he moves on anything."
"Something's happening," Bach said. His eyes flickered over to his calendar.
I suddenly became conscious of the eyes of three or four other customers in the store. It was late, true, but the occult community doesn't exactly keep standard hours, and Halloween was only 2 days off. Scratch that, it was almost 1 a.m. Tomorrow was Halloween. That meant trick-or-treating for some people, but it meant sacred Samhain for others. And there were a number of other beliefs attached to the day in the occult circles. There was shopping to be done.
"It might be," I told Bach. "You might want to be behind a threshold after dark for the next day or two, just to be careful."
Bach's expression told me that he thought I wasn't telling him everything. I gave him a look that told him to mind his own damned business and headed for the back of the store. Bach's shop was bigger than you'd have expected from the outside. It had been a speakeasy back in the day, fronting as a neighborhood grocery. The front of the store offered a browsing area for customers interested in purchasing everything from crystals to incense to candles to oils to wands and other symbolic instruments of ritual magic, your typical New Agey stuff. There were various statues and idols for personal shrines, meditation mats, bits of furniture, and other decoration for any alternative religion you'd care to name, including some figures of Buddha and Ganesh. Behind the occult area were several rows of bookshelves holding one of the largest selections in town of books on the occult, the paranormal, and the mystical. Most of the books were chock-full of philosophy or religion, predominantly Wiccan of one flavor or another, but there were several texts slanted toward Hindu beliefs drawn from the Kabbalah, voodoo, and even a couple grounded in ancient beliefs in the Norse or Greek gods. I steered clear of the whole mess myself. Magic wasn't something you needed God, a god, or gods to help you with, but a lot of people felt differently than I did. Even some wizards of the council held deep religious convictions and felt that they were bound intricately to their magic. Of course, if they believed it, it was as good as true. Magic is closely interwoven with a wizard's confidence. Some would say that it is bound up with a wizard's faith, and it would mean practically the same thing. You have to believe in the magic for it to work, not just that it will happen, but that it should happen. That's what makes people like Gravain so dangerous. Magic is essentially a force of creation, of life. Gravain's necromancy made a mockery of life, even as he used it to destroy. Besides being murderous and extremely icky, there was something utterly profane about using magic to create a rotting semblance of a human life. My stomach turned a little, just thinking about what it might be like to work a spell like that. And Gravain believed in it, which really seemed to make him look more and more like some kind of wacko, a deadly, powerful, calm, and intelligent lunatic. I shook my head. How do I get myself into this kind of crap? I walked through the bookshelves to a door in the back wall. While it wasn't precisely hidden, the door had no frame and was set flush with the wall around it and was covered with the same paneling as the wall. Once it had opened to allow customers to slip into a private area to drink illegal booze. Now it was locked. I used Bach's key to open it and let myself into the back of the store. The rear area wasn't large, nothing more than a single room with an office built into one corner and a pair of long bookshelves set behind a heavy iron grill on the wall opposite. The room was full of boxes, shelves, tables, where Bach would keep his spare inventory, if any, and where he handled his mail order business. There were a couple of safety lights glowing on outlets on the walls. The office door was partly open and the light was on. I heard the office radio playing quietly on a classic rock station. I went to the door set in the iron grill and unlocked it, then rolled open the cage door. Bach kept all his valuable texts in the cage. He He had an original first printing of Through the Looking Glass by Lewis Carroll, autographed, on the highest shelf, carefully sealed in plastic, and several dozen other rare books, some of them even more valuable. The remaining shelves were filled with serious texts on magic theory. A lot of them were almost as occluded with opinion and philosophy as their more modern counterparts on the shelves in the front of the store. The difference was that most of them were written by members of the council at one time or another. There were very few volumes that addressed magic in its most elemental sense, as a pure source of energy, the way I'd been taught about it. One of the notable exceptions was Elementary Magic by Ebenezer McCoy. It was the first book most wizards ever handed an apprentice. It dealt with the nuts and bolts of moving energy around and stressed the need for control and responsibility on behalf of the wizard. Though now that I thought about it, Ebenezer hadn't handed me a copy of the book when he'd been teaching me. He hadn't even lectured me more than a couple of times. He told me what he expected, and then he lived it in front of me. Damned effective teaching method to my way of thinking. I drew out a copy of his book and stared at it for a moment. My stomach fluttered a little. Of course, he'd been lying to me, too, or at least not telling me the whole truth. And the whole time he'd been teaching me, he'd been under orders from the council to execute me if I wasn't perfectly behaved. I hadn't been perfect. The old man didn't kill me, but he didn't trust me enough to come clean, either. He didn't tell me that he was in charge of dirty jobs for the council, that he was their wet works man, the one who broke the laws of magic with their blessing, who betrayed the same responsibility he wrote about, talked about, and had apparently lived. "He was trying to protect you, Harry," I told myself. That didn't make it right. "He never tried to be your hero, your role model. You did that." That didn't change a damn thing. "He never wanted to hurt you. He had the best intentions. And the road to hell is paved with them. You need to get over it. You need to forgive him." I slammed the book back onto the shelf, hard. "Hello?" called a woman's voice from behind me. I nearly jumped out of my skin. My staff clattered to the ground, and when I spun around, my shield bracelet was up and spitting sparks, and my .44 was in my right hand, pointing at the office. She was young, mid-twenties at most. She was dressed in a long wool skirt, a turtleneck, and a cardigan sweater, all in colors of gray. She had hair of medium brown, held up into a bun with a pair of pencils, wore glasses, and had a heart-shaped face that was more attractive than beautiful, her features soft and appealing. She had a smudge mark of ink on her chin and on the fingers of her right hand, and she wore a name tag that had the store logo at the top and, "Hi, my name is Sheila," below it.
"Oh,"
she said, and stiffened, becoming very pale.
"Just take what you want. I won't do anything."
I let out my breath between my teeth and slowly lowered the gun. For crying out loud, I'd nearly started shooting. Tense much, Harry? I let go of the energy running through the shield bracelet, and it dimmed as well. "Excuse me, miss," I said as politely as I could manage. "You startled me." She blinked at me for a second, confusion on her features.
"Oh,"
she said then.
"You aren't robbing the store?"
"No," I said.
"That's good."
She put a hand to her chest, breathing a little quickly. It had to be a fairly generous chest, given that I could notice the curves of her breasts even through the cardigan. Ah, trusty libido. Even when I am up to my ears in trouble, you are there to distract me from such trivial matters as survival.
"Oh, then you're a customer, I suppose. May I help you?"
"I was just looking for a book," I said.
"Well," she said with businesslike cheer, "flick on that lamp next to you, to begin with, and we'll find what you're looking for."
I did, and Sheila smoothed her skirts and walked over to me. She was average height, maybe 5'6", which made her approximately a foot shorter than me. She paused as she got closer and peered up at me.
"You're him," she said. "You're Harry Dresden."
"That's what the IRS keeps telling me," I said.
"Wow,"
she said, her eyes bright. She had very dark eyes that went well with skin like cream,
and as she got closer, I saw that her outfit did a lot to conceal some pleasant curves. She wasn't going to be modeling bikinis anywhere, but she looked like she'd be very pleasant to curl up with on a cold night. Man, I needed to date more or something. I rubbed at my eyes and got my mind back on business.
"I've wanted to meet you," she said, "ever since I came to Chicago."
"You new in town? I haven't seen you here before."
6 months, she said. 5 working here.
"Bach works you pretty late," I said. She nodded and brushed a curl of hair away from her cheek, leaving a smudge of dark ink on it.
"End of the month. I'm doing books and inventory."
Then she looked stricken and said,
"Oh, I didn't even introduce myself."
"Sheila?" I guessed. She stared at me for a second, then flushed and said,
"Oh, right, the name tag."
I stuck out my hand. "I'm Harry." She shook my hand. Her grip was firm, soft, warm, and tingled with the energy of someone who had some kind of minor talent to practice. I'd never really considered what it might be like for someone to sense my own aura. Sheila drew in a sharp breath, and her arm jumped. Her ink-stained fingers squeezed tight for a second and smudged my hand.
"Oh, sorry, sorry."
I rubbed my hand on my fatigue pants. "I've seen worse stains tonight," I said, "which brings me to the books."
"You stained a book?"
she said, her face and voice distressed. "No, that was just a bad segue."
Oh, right,"
she said, nodding. She absently rubbed her hands together.
"You're here for a book. What are you looking for?"
"A book called Die Lied der Erlking."
"Oh, I've read that one."
She scrunched up her nose, eyes distant for a second, and said,
"2 copies, right-hand shelf, 3rd row from the top, 8th and 9th books from the left."
I blinked at her, then went to the shelf and found the book where she'd said. "Wow, good call."
"Eidetic memory," she said with a pleased smile. "It's sort of my talent."
She gestured vaguely with the hand she'd touched me with.
"Must come in handy during inventory."
I checked the shelf. "There's only 1 copy, though." She frowned, then shrugged.
"Mr. Bach must have sold one this week."
"I bet he did," I said, troubled. It bothered me to think about Gravain standing in the store, speaking to people like Bach or Sheila. I pulled the cage closed and started slowly from the front of the store. I opened the book. I'd heard it referenced before in other works. It was supposed to deal with the lore around the Erlkönig, or Elf King. He was supposed to be a fairy figure of considerable power, maybe a counterpart to the queens of the fairy courts. The book had been compiled by Wizard Peabody, early last century, from the collected notes of 12 different crusty wizards, most of them dead at the time, and was considered to be a work of nearly pure speculation.
"How much?" I asked.
"Should be on an index card inside the cover," Sheila said, walking politely beside me.
I looked. The book was worth 1/2 a month's rent. No wonder I'd never bought a copy. Business hadn't been bad lately, but between handling all of Mouse's licensing and shots and the trucks of food he ate, and Thomas's job troubles, I didn't have anything to spare. Maybe Bach would let me lease it or something. Sheila and I walked out of the back room and started toward the front of the store. As we came out of the book areas, she said,
"Well, I think you know the way from here. It was a pleasure meeting you, Harry."
"You too," I said, smiling. Hey, she was a woman and pretty enough. Her smile was simply adorable. "Maybe I'll bump into you again sometime."
"I'd like that. Only next time, without the gun."
"One of those old-fashioned girls, huh?" I said. She laughed and walked back toward the rear of the store.
"Find what you need?" Bach asked.
There was an edge to his voice, something I couldn't quite place. He was definitely uncomfortable.
"I hope so," I said. About the price."
Bach looked at me hard from under his thick eyebrows.
Would you take a check?"
He looked around the store and then nodded.
"Sure. From you."
"Thanks," I said. I wrote out a check, hoping it wouldn't bounce before I got to the door, and sneaked my own glance around the shop.
"Did I run out your customers?"
"Maybe," he said uncomfortably.
"Sorry," I said. "It happens."
"Might be better for them to be home. You too, in fact." He shook his head.
"I have a business to run."
He was an adult, and he'd been in this town longer than I had. All right, I said. I handed him the check. Did you sell the other copy you had in inventory? He put the check in the register and put the book into a plastic bag, zipped it shut, then put that in a paper sack. 2 days ago, he said after a moment's thought. Do you remember to whom? He puffed out a breath that flapped his jowls. Old gentleman, long hair, thinning, spots. Real loose skin, I asked, moved kind of stiff. Bach looked around again, nervous. Yeah, that's him. Look, Mr. Dresden, I just run the shop, okay? I don't want to get involved with any trouble. I had no idea who the guy was. He was just a customer. All right, I told him. Thanks, Bach. He nodded and passed over the book. I folded the sack, book and all, into a pocket on my duster and fished my car keys out of my pocket. Harry, came Sheila's voice, low and urgent. I blinked and looked up at her. Yeah? She nodded toward the front of the store, her face anxious. I looked out. On the street outside the shop stood two figures. They were dressed more or less identically. Long black robes, long black cape, big black mantles, big black hoods that showed nothing of the faces inside. One was taller than the other, but other than that, they simply stood on the sidewalk outside, waiting. I told these guys last week I didn't want to buy a ring, I said. I glanced at Sheila. See that? Witty under pressure. That was a Tolkien joke. Huh, said Bach, more than a little uneasy. I don't want any trouble here, Mr. Dresden. Relax, Bach, I said. If they wanted trouble, they'd have kicked down the door. They're here to talk to you? Sheila asked. Probably, I said. Of course, if they were more of Kemmler's knitting circle, they might just walk up and try to kill me. Gravain had. I drummed my fingers thoughtfully along the solid wood of my wizard's staff. Bach looked at me, his expression a little queasy. He wasn't an easy man to frighten, but he was no fool either. I had wrecked at least four buildings during my cases in the last several years, and he didn't want Bach-ordered books to be appended to the list. That hurt a little. Normals looked at me like I was insane when I told people I was a wizard. People who were in the know didn't look at me like I was insane. They looked at me like I was insanely dangerous. I guess at least four buildings later, they'd got reason to think so. Maybe you better close up shop for the night, I told Bach and Sheila. I'll go out and talk to them. Chapter 8. I paused just before I opened the shop's door and walked outside. It was one of those moments that would have had dramatic music if my life were a movie, but instead I got a radio jingle for some kind of submarine sandwich place blaring over the store's ambient stereo. The movie of my life must be really low budget. The trick was to figure out which movie I was in. If this was a variant on High Noon, then walking outside was probably a fairly dangerous idea. On the other hand, there was always the chance that I was still in the opening scenes of the Maltese Falcon, and everyone trying to chase down the bird still wanted to talk to me. In which case, this was probably a good chance to dig for vital information about what might well be a growing storm around the search for the word of Kemmler. But just in case, I shook out my shield bracelet to the ready. I took my staff in hand and settled my fingers around it in a solid grip, curling them to the sigil-carved surface of the wood one by one. Then I called up my power. Like I said, magic comes from life, and especially from emotions. They're a source of the same intangible energy that everyone can feel when an autumn moon rises and fills you with a sudden sense of bone-deep excitement, or when the first warm breeze of spring rushes past your face full of the sense of life and drowns you in a sudden flood of unreasoning joy. The passion of mighty music that brings tears to your eyes and the raw, bubbling, infectious laughter of small children at play. The bellowing power of a stadium full of football fans shouting, "Hey!" in time to that damn song. They're all charged with magic. My magic comes from the same places, and maybe from darker places than that. Fear is an emotion, too, so is rage, so is lust and madness. I'm not a particularly good person. I'm no Charles Manson or anything, but I'm not going to be up for canonization either. Though in the past, I think maybe I was a better person than I am today. In the past, I hadn't seen so many people hurt and killed and terrorized by the same kind of power that damn well should have been making the world a nicer place, or at the least, staying the hell away from it. I hadn't made so many mistakes back then. So many short-sighted decisions, some of which had cost people their lives. I had been sure of myself. I had been whole. My stupid hand hurt like hell. I had half a dozen really gut-wrenchingly good reasons to be afraid, and I was. Worst of all, if I made any mistakes, Murphy was going to be the one to pay for it. If that happened, I didn't know what I would do. I drew it all in, the good, the bad, and the crazy, a low buzz that coursed through the air and rattled the idols and candles and incense holders on their shelves in the store around me. In the glass door of the shop, I saw my left hand vanish, replaced with an irregular globe of angry blue light that trailed bits of heatless fire to the floor. I pulled in the energy from all around me, readying myself to defend, to attack, to protect, or to destroy. I didn't know what the two cloaked figures wanted, but I wanted them to know that if they'd come looking for a fight, I'd be willing to oblige them. I held my power around me like a cloak and slipped out to face the pair waiting for me on the sidewalk. I took my time, every step unhurried and precise. I kept an eye on them, but only in my peripheral vision. Otherwise, I left my eyes on the ground and walked slowly, until the blue glow of my shield light fell on their dark robes, making the black look blue, darkening the shadows and the folds to hues too dark to have names. Then I stopped and lifted my eyes slowly, daring them to meet my gaze. It might have been my imagination, but I thought the pair of them rocked back a little, swaying like reeds before an oncoming storm. October wind blew about us, freezing cold air that took its chill from the icy depths of Lake Michigan. "What do you want?" I asked them. I borrowed frost from the wind and put it in my voice. The larger of the pair spoke.
"That book."
"But which book?" I wondered.
"Uh-huh. You're a Schubert fanboy, aren't you? You've got the look."
"Goethe, actually,"
he said.
"Give it to me."
He was definitely after a copy of Der Erlking, then. His voice was odd. Male, certainly, but it didn't sound quite human. There was a kind of quavering buzz in it that made it warble somehow, made the words slither uncertainly. The words were slow and enunciated. They had to be, in order to be intelligible.
"Bite me," I answered him. "Get your own book, Kemmlerite."
"I have nothing but disdain for the madman Kemmler,"
he spat.
"Have a care what insults you offer. This need not involve you at all, Dresden."
That gave me a moment's pause, as they say. Taking on arrogant, powerful, dark wizards is one thing. Taking on ones who have done their homework and who know who you are is something else entirely. It was my turn to be rattled. The dark figure noted it. His not-human voice swayed into the night again in a low laugh. "Touché, O dark master of evil bathrobes," I said. "But I'm still not giving you my copy of the book."
"I am called Cowl,"
he said. Was there amusement in his voice? Maybe.
"And I am feeling patient this evening. Again, I will ask it. Give me your copy of the book."
Die Lied der Erlking bumped against my leg through the pocket of my duster. "And again I do answer thee, bite me."
"Thrice will I ask, and done,"
said the figure, warning in its tone. "Gee, let me think. How am I going to answer this time?" I said, planting my feet on the ground. Cowl made a hissing sound and spread its arms slightly, hands still low by its hips. The cold wind off the lake began to blow harder.
Thrice I ask and done,
Cowl said, his voice low, hard, angry.
Give me the book.
Suddenly the second figure took a step forward and said, in a female version of Cowl's weird voice,
Please.
There was a second of shocked silence, and then Cowl snarled,
Kumori, mind your tongue.
There is no cost in being polite,
said the smaller of the two, Kumori. The robes were too thick and shapeless to give any hint at her form, but there was something decidedly feminine in the gesture she made with one hand, a roll of her wrist. She faced me again and said,
The knowledge in Der Erlking is about to become dangerous, Dresden,
she said.
You need not give us the book. Simply destroy it here. That will be sufficient. I ask it of you. Please.
I looked between the two of them for a moment, then I said, I've seen you both before. Neither of them moved. At Bianca's masquerade. You were on the dais with her. As I spoke the words, I became increasingly convinced of them. The two figures I'd seen back then had never shown their faces, but there was something in the way that Cowl and Kumori moved that matched the two shadows back then precisely. You were the ones who gave the Lenanshi that athame.
Perhaps,
said Kumori, but there was an inclination to her head that seeded me the truth of my statement. That was such an amazingly screwed-up evening. It's been coming back to haunt me for years, I said.
And will for years to come, said Cowl. A great many things of significance happened that night, most of which you are not yet aware.
Hell's bells, I complained. I'm a wizard, and I still get sick of that I-know-and-you-don't shtick. In fact, it pisses me off even faster than it used to. Cowl and Kumori exchanged a long look, and then Kumori said,
Dresden, if you would spare yourself and others grief and pain, destroy the book.
Is that what you're doing? I asked, going around trashing copies.
There were fewer than 1,000 printed, Kumori confirmed. Time has taken most of them. Over the past month, we have accounted for the rest, but for 2 here, in Chicago, in this store.
Why? I demanded. Cowl moved his shoulders in the barest hint of a shrug.
Is it not enough that Kemmler's disciples could use this knowledge for great evil?
Are you with the council? I responded.
Obviously not,
Kumori replied from the depths of her hood. Uh-huh, I said. Seems to me that if you were on the up and up, you'd be working with the council, rather than running around reinterpreting Fahrenheit 451 from a ringwraith perspective.
And it seems to me, Kumori answered smoothly, that if you believed that their motives were as pure as they claim, you would already have notified them yourself.
Hello. Now that was a new tune. Someone suggesting that the council was bent and I was in the right. I wasn't sure what Kumori was trying to do, but it was smartest to play this out and see what she had to say. Who says I haven't?
This is pointless,
Cowl said. Kumori said, Let me tell him.
Pointless.
It costs nothing,
Kumori said. It's going to if you keep dawdling, I said. I'm going to start billing you for wasting my time. She made a weird sound that I only just recognized as a sigh.
Can you believe, at least, that the contents of the book are dangerous?
Gravain had seemed fond enough of his copy, but I wouldn't know for sure what the big stink was about until I had time to read the book myself. For the sake of expediency, let's say that I do.
If the knowledge inside the book is dangerous,
Cowl said.
What makes you think that the wardens or the council would use it any more wisely than Kemmler's disciples?
Because while they're a bunch of enormous assholes, they always try to do the right thing, I said. If one of the wardens thought he might be about to practice black magic, he'd probably cut off his own head on pure reflex.
All of them?
Kumori asked in a quiet voice.
Are you sure?
I looked back and forth between them. Are you telling me that someone on the council is after Kemmler's power?
The council is not what it was, said Cow. It has rotted from the inside, and many wizards who have chafed at its restrictions have seen the war with the Red Court reveal its weakness. It will fall, soon, perhaps before tomorrow night.
Oh, I drawled. Well, gee, why didn't you say so? I'll just hand you my copy of the book right now. Kumori held up a hand.
This is no deception, Dresden. The world is changing. The Council's end is near, and those who wish to survive it must act now, before it is too late.
I took a deep breath. Normally, I'm the first one to suggest we TP the Council's house, I said. But you're talking about necromancy, black magic. You aren't going to convince me that the Council and the Wardens have suddenly gotten a yen to trot down the left-hand path. They won't touch the stuff.
Ideally, Cowl said, you are young, Dresden, and you have much to learn.
You know what young me has learned? Not to spend too much time listening to the advice of people who want to get something out of me, I said, which includes car salesmen, political candidates, and weirdos in black capes who mug me on the street in the middle of the night.
Enough,
Cowl said, anger making his voice almost unintelligible.
Give us the book!
Bite my ass, Cowl. Kumori's hood twitched back and forth between Cowl and me. She took three steps back.
Just as well,
Cowl murmured.
I have wanted to see for myself what has the warden so nervous about you.
The cold wind rose again, and the hairs on the back of my neck rose up stiffly. A flash of sensation flickered over me as Cowl drew in power. A lot of power. Don't, I said. I lifted my shield bracelet, weaving defensive energy before me with my thoughts. I solidified my hold on my own power, wrapping my fingers tight around my staff, and then slammed it down hard on the concrete. The cracking sound of it echoed back and forth from darkened buildings and the empty street. Walk away. I'm not kidding.
Garrosh,
he snarled in reply, and extended his right hand. He hit me with raw, invisible force, pure will, focused into a violent burst of kinetic energy. I knew it was coming. My shield was ready, and I braced myself against it in precisely the correct way. My defense was perfect. It was all that saved my life. I've traded practice blows with my old master, Justin de Morne, himself at one time a warden. I fought him in earnest, too, and won. I've tested my strength in practice duels against the mentor who succeeded him, Ebenezer McCoy. My fairy godmother, the Lenanshi, has a seriously nasty right hook, metaphysically speaking, and I've even gone up against the least of the queens of fairy. Throw in a couple of demons, various magical constructs, a 13-story fall in a runaway elevator, half a dozen spell slingers of one amount of nasty or another, and I've seen more sheer mystic violence than most wizards in the business. I've beaten them all, or at least survived them, and I've got the scars to show for it. Cowl hit me harder than any of them. My shield lit up like a floodlight, and despite all that I could do to divert the energy he threw at me, it hit me like a professional linebacker on an adrenaline frenzy. If I hadn't been able to smooth it out and take the blow evenly across the whole front of my body, it might have broken my nose or ribs or collarbone, depending on where the energy bled through. Instead, it felt like the Jolly Green Giant had slugged me with a family-sized beanbag. If there had been any upward force on it, it would have thrown me far enough to make me worry about the fall. But the blow came head-on, driving me straight back. I flew several yards in the air, hit on my back, scraped along the sidewalk, and managed to turn the momentum into a roll. I staggered to my feet, leaning hard against a parked car. I must have clipped my head at some point, because stars were swirling around in my vision. By the time I got myself upright again, the panic had set in. No one had ever thrown power like that at me. Stars and stones. If I hadn't been absolutely prepared for that blow. I swallowed. I'd be dead. Or at least broken, bleeding, and utterly at the mercy of an unknown wizard. one who was still nearby and probably getting ready to hit me again. I forced thoughts and doubts from my mind and readied my shield, my bracelet already grown so warm that I could feel it through the ugly scars on the skin of my wrist. I couldn't even think about hitting back, because if my shield wasn't back up and ready for another blow, I wouldn't live long enough to get the chance. Cowl walked slowly toward me down the sidewalk, all cloak and hood and shadows.
"Disappointing," he said. "I hoped you were ready for the heavyweight division."
He flicked his wrist, and the next blow howled at me in the freezing wind blowing off the lake. This one came in at an angle, and I didn't even try to stop it cold. I sidestepped like a nervous horse, angling my shield to deflect the blow. Again, energy leaked through, but this time it only shoved me across the sidewalk. My shoulder hit the building, and it drove the breath out of me. I've had shoulder injuries before, and it probably made it feel worse than it was. I bounced off the building and kept my feet, but my legs wobbled, not from the effort of holding me up, but from the energy I'd had to expend to survive the attacks. Cowl kept walking toward me. Hell's bells. It didn't even look like he was trying all that hard. I got a cold feeling in my chest. This man could kill me.
"The book, boy," Cowl said. "Now!"
What rose up in me then wasn't outrage or terror. It wasn't righteous wrath. It wasn't confidence or surety or determination to protect a loved one. It was 100% pure, contrary stubbornness. Chicago was my town. I didn't care who this joker was. He wasn't going to come gliding down the streets of my town and push in my teeth for my milk money. I don't get pushed around by anyone. Cowl was strong, but his magic wasn't inhuman. It was huge, and it was different from what I worked with, but it didn't have that nauseating, greasy, somehow empty feel that I'd come to associate with the worst black magic. No, that wasn't entirely true. There was a lingering sense of black magic involved in his power. Then again, there's a little of it in mine, too. The point being that Cowl wasn't some kind of demon. He was a wizard. Human. And, behind the magic, just as fragile as me. I poured power down my arm, whirled my staff, pointed it at the car on the street beside him, and snarled, "Fozare!" The sigils on my staff burst into sudden hellish scarlet light, as bright as the blaze of my shield, and shimmering waves of force flowed out from me. They flooded out over the sidewalk, under the Toyota parked on the street nearest Cowl. I snarled with effort, and the hellfire force abruptly lashed up underneath the street side of the car. The car flipped up as lightly and quickly as a man overturning a kitchen chair. Cowl was under it. There was a crash, and hell's bells, it was loud. Glass shattered everywhere, and sparks flew out in every direction. The car's alarm went off, warbling drunkenly, and alarms started going off all up and down the street. In apartment windows, lights started blinking on. I fell to one knee, suddenly exhausted, the light from staff and shield both dwindling to nothing and vanishing. I had never moved that much mass before, that quickly, with nothing but raw kinetic energy, and I could hardly find enough energy to focus my eyes. If I hadn't had the staff to lean on, I'd have been hugging the sidewalk. There was the sound of metal grating on concrete. "Oh, come on," I said, panting. The car shuddered, then slid a few inches to one side. Cowl straightened slowly. He'd gotten back to the very rear of the car's impact area somehow, and he must have been able to shield himself from the partial impact. As he straightened, he wavered, then braced himself against a streetlight with one black-gloved hand. I felt a surge of satisfaction. "Take that, jerk." A low, growling sound came warbling out of the black hood.
"The book."
"Bite?" I panted. "Me." But he hadn't been talking to me. Kumori stepped out of the shadows of a doorway and gestured with a whispered word. I felt a sudden, strong tug.